Welcome once again to TNT's Will Podcast, the official companion podcast of the TNT series Will. I'm your host, Michael Wood, and with me is the creator and executive producer of Will, Craig Pearce. Good to see you again, Craig.
Always great to talk, Michael.
Episode 7, Dream On of Bloody Deeds and Death. The series does get bloodier as it goes on, doesn't it?
In true Shakespearean fashion.
I mean, Topcliffe becomes a major, major character, and I not quite expected how big a character he would be. And we'll talk further about that. But the insights we get into the mind of a psychopath, and these kind of psychopaths are with us today, aren't they? They're in every period, these people who use power to cause pain.
Yes, it's a character type. And as we've spoken about before, one of Shakespeare's, I think, greatest talents and probably unique amongst writers for the breadth and scope of it is his ability to see into the human heart and the human nature and really divine what a character is and to draw that character so accurately. And also with such compassion, because even a character, you know, even some of the worst of Shakespeare's characters, you know, like Richard III, Lady Macbeth, they're drawn both starkly and terrifyingly, but with moments of great compassion. And so that makes them feel human and makes them all the more terrifying, because we know that true evil is truly human. You know, I think Topcliffe was one of those sorts of people that we see again and again through history. You know, Topcliffe was a member of Parliament. He wasn't an aristocrat, but he did have wealth and he did have land. And at a certain point, and he was close to the Queen and the court, and at a certain point when Elizabeth was young, he raised a small portion of an army, a band of about 20 or 30 soldiers to join the local lord in putting down a northern rebellion. And he was put in charge of interrogating the prisoners. And I think he did it very well. And I think he probably liked it a little bit too much. And I think that was the beginning of his career as you know, chief inquisitor of political prisoners, particularly Catholics.
We'll come back to Topcliffe when we've seen this episode, when we turn to episode 8. But another thing that, you know, that episode 7 begins with the explosive scene with the theatre on fire. I mean, you've telescoped history in a way, but quite legitimately, it seems to me, because what it shows you is that an unstable and uncertain business the theatre was then, and you literally could be ruined overnight, couldn't
you? That's right.
And any theatre company needed a wealthy patron and a powerful patron to support
to protect
them. Not only because of Dosh, but to protect them.
Yes. Of course, as we know, the Globe Theatre, which was what the theatre turned into when it moved across the river to Southwark, there was a big fire, and it wasn't destroyed, but it nearly was, and it was set on fire by cannon wadding that lodged in the thatch roof. And there are other reports of actually riots and a theatre burning down. So, you know, they were big wooden structures and not much health and safety, so prone to fire. And yes, you could be ruined overnight. It was very much like, I equate it like, you know, rock and roll in the early 70s. You know, lots of cash, big bags of cash, you know, no one's really paying much tax, flying by the seat of your pants. And you could make money, or you could be ruined overnight. And we see with Burbage, I mean, I think Burbage was probably a visionary. He did build the first dedicated theatre in London, and certainly the first that went on to be a success. But, you know, he was always broke. There are many reports of him owing money and lots of fights over money and suing, and it was, of course, a very litigious society. And I think he was a visionary, but not so great at business. And I think Henslow, who ran the Rose Theatre, I think he was probably not so great with the vision thing, but a really good manager and actually quite There are many reports of Henslowe had all these ways of, well, I'll lend you this money for this, and okay, instead of paying me back, you can write me a play, but now you owe me this, and oh, I'll lend you the cloak, but now you have to pay rent on the cloak, and just these incredible schemes to be profitable. And I don't think Burbage was like that. I think he was the big ideas guy, and Burbage did, for many years, try and open the first indoor theatre in London, Blackfriars. Mm-hmm. And there was this, oh, it's hilarious because it's so modern. There was a very big not in my backyard movement from the wealthy, because Blackfriars was a wealthy area and Burbage wanted to make the first indoor theatre in a wealthy area and charge high ticket prices, smaller clientele, illumination by candles, so playing at night. Out of the
winter,
weather.
Winter performances.
Well. And they were like, we're not having a theatre in our backyard.
Players in our neighbourhood.
That's right. even though they would go to the public playhouse. So that did nearly ruin him because he'd taken out the lease. And eventually they did open Blackfriars, of course, but that was many years later.
Great. Okay, episode 7, two more kind of questions. Marlowe, first of all, and who is... this strange rival and alter ego, almost, you know, their relationship is quite fascinating in the show. And but you've got Marlowe dabbling in all these occult theories of the School of Night these kind of things.
Just
tell us a little bit about, did that kind of thing really exist?
Absolutely. There was the School of Night and... there was the School of Night. There was Dr. John Dees, who was the Queen's chief mathematician and astrologer and astronomer. And the thing is, science and what we would call the occult today, there was really no divide, because it was the Elizabethan Renaissance and people's minds were exploding with new knowledge and inquiry, and they wanted to know how the universe worked and how God related to man and the spirit world. And, you know, if you went to a doctor, they'd probably prescribe you a herbal kind of potion, which actually may have done some good. They'd read your urine. They'd look at your urine. And, you know, there's probably some method to some veracity to, you know, to look at someone's urine and see if it's cloudy or not. But then they'd do your star chart. They'd give you spells. They might give you a claw and a thing to wear around your neck. And it was all completely legitimate in the terms of an Elizabethan person. So this thing of Marlowe, he goes on this very dark journey because he's trying to, you know, he's dealing with the death of his lover at this point. So he's trying to understand his own mortality, deal with his own grief. And he feels that he's damned because, of course, to have that kind of male love at that time, well, in some people's eyes, even today, damns you for all time in the eyes of God. And he's lost his the great love of his life, Barrett Emerson, and he's trying to both deal with that and try to connect somehow with what he's lost.
And that connects with things that we know about the real Marlowe. I mean, he was an atheist. He was gay.
Yeah.
As well, we use the word gay today.
Yeah.
And always pushing the boundaries. He was interested in the occult.
Yes.
I mean, you tie it in with his development of a play about selling your soul to the devil.
Exactly.
I mean, Dr. Faustus, through this series, in a way, you've very cleverly shadowed the drama in their real lives.
Yes. And of course, you know, Faust was a sensation on the Elizabethan stage, and there are reports of people actually seeing the devil on stage watching Faust because they were so mesmerized and, you know, perhaps caught up in some kind of, you know, mass hypnosis kind of feeling, because the idea of the devil being a real presence was absolutely uncontroversial in Elizabethan times. You know, there was good and there was evil and there was God and the devil. And I think we know that Marlowe died young and violently, and we know he was transgressive to that society. And yes, I think he was, you know, in the Elizabethan world, he didn't really define things as gay, people as gay or straight or bisexual. People sort of just had sex, and a little bit of kind of dabbling was fine. But you didn't, you know, marry a man if you're a man and set up house and live a gay life. You just couldn't. And, you know, quite possibly Marlowe wanted to and felt trapped and damned in his own society. And I think that's what Faust is about, trying to make some bargain with the devil so he can be the real him, so he can find the ultimate knowledge that purportedly the devil will give you. But of course, the price you have to pay for that is damned for all time.
And I suppose, you know, you're looking at those scenes, we come back to the big picture that we saw in episode one, which is that they are uniquely almost living in a time of right on the cusp of change.
That's
it's
right.
kind of no
That's
longer
right.
and yeah. it's not yet.
Yeah.
It's the world of superstition. It's the world of science. It's the world of traditional religious belief. The traditional belief has been destroyed. It's the world of the collective old medieval society,
yes.
the rational individualist, the self-fashioning, reflexive individual person. All these things, Shakespeare and Marlowe and their contemporaries, are living absolutely at the moment when all these things are in play, aren't they?
Yes.
If he'd been born 10 years before or 10 years after, he'd never have...
No, that's right. That's why it's such a fascinating time. The Elizabethan time was right on the cusp of change from the old to the new. And I think we're a little bit in that same time in our world today where so many of the traditional beliefs are both so strong but also kind of feel like they need to change or people want them to change. And, you know, you look at politics today and all around the world, both in the East and the West, there is political turmoil. You know, whatever you think of Donald Trump, whether you're a supporter or not, certainly he is a novel kind of president in that he doesn't have any political background or expertise. And for a lot of the people who voted for him, that's absolutely why they did vote for him, because people feel change. They want change. It's a volatile time in our world, and volatility is about old ideas changing into new ideas, but actually harkening back to the old ideas. And it was very much the same in Elizabethan times.
Many thanks, Craig. Illuminating as ever. And we look forward very much to hearing from you next week.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Join me next Tuesday for an all-new episode of TNT's Will Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to TNT's Will Podcast in the Apple Podcasts app. And please leave a rating and a review while you're there. And remember, Will is all new Mondays at 9 on TNT. I'm Michael Wood. Thanks for listening.